This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The heart of any fan is bound to make a loudly beating sound when fantasies of playing start to bloom inside that fan's full heart. It's playing with the pros, I mean, on pristine fields or ice that's clean, with refs and whistles cheering, too. If they can do it, why not you? For watching's cool, but playing, man, can you imagine? Some folks can. We'll start today's show with a wild tale set in the New Year's Eve just past. But don't worry, it's not R-rated. This one's okay for the kids. Better than okay. Actually, maybe even inspirational. Only a Game's Martin Kessler has the story.
This is a story about a guy you've probably never heard of. His name's George Alves.
Trust me, I'm not used to getting requests for interviews and stuff.
George is an equipment manager for the NHL's Carolina Hurricanes. It's a job you might call thankless. At the very least, it doesn't get him in front of many microphones. George is responsible for things like keeping players' skates sharp and their sticks taped. The Hurricanes' players seem to really love George. He's been working with the team for 13 years, and George loves his job.
You know, I like to serve people. Like, I enjoy being able to help the guys get ready for a game, whatever they might need.
In this past New Year's Eve, the Hurricanes players needed George to do something that's way outside his job description. He called his wife right away.
Even just thinking about it right now makes me a little emotional, because when my wife answered the phone, I said, honey, it's going to happen tonight. And I remember she said, she goes, are you kidding? Is this a joke? And and I said, no, honey, it's not a joke. This is happening.
What happened that night landed George on ESPN, CBS, and in the pages of Sports Illustrated. George is 37 years old. He grew up playing street hockey. His family didn't really have money for him to join organized teams. He played goalie for his middle school and high school, then enlisted in the Marines, which lacked a hockey team. During his 4 years of service, George met a woman from North Carolina. They got married. Then George enrolled at NC State and played for the club team. He spent the next few years after graduating suiting up for local minor league clubs like the Asheville Aces, the South Carolina Stingrays, and my personal favorite, the late Greenville Growl. That's Growl with three R's. It wasn't an easy time for George and his new wife. He wasn't making much money, and his chances of reaching the NHL were basically zero.
I wasn't a goalie that was sought after. I had no resume.
Then, 9 years ago, George and his wife had their first child. A minor league hockey salary was no longer an option.
You know, I just looked at it as in, I need to do something to support a family, and that was going to be hard to do, bouncing around in the minors and trying to continue to chase the dream.
So George embraced a new dream. Instead of minding the net, he would mind the locker room, and the laundry, and the gear. He got a job as an equipment manager with a minor league team, and worked his way up to his current gig with the Hurricanes. Turned out the job came with a pretty cool perk.
You know, whenever they needed a goalie in practice, I'd fill in and give the guys a chance or someone else to shoot on.
So even though George stopped playing competitively almost a decade ago, he still tries to stay in shape. And the team asked him to keep his gear with him on the road. On New Year's Eve, that turned out to be a really good thing, because a few hours before the team's game that night in Florida, George got a call from one of Carolina's assistant general managers. The backup goalie was sick. Now, Carolina's starting goalie was perfectly healthy, and you only need one goalie to play a hockey game. But the NHL has a rule that teams must always dress a backup. There wasn't time for the Hurricanes to call up one of their prospects from a minor league affiliate. So George Alves, equipment manager, was going to dress for an NHL game. Maybe now you can understand why George is so emotional when he thinks back on that phone call telling his wife about the opportunity.
I'm just thinking about, you know, how much I appreciate her. You know, just all the sacrifices she went through as far as me chasing a dream and trying to even play in the minor leagues. To have that feeling of telling her after all these years of you putting up with me and kind of not telling me, hey, this is never going to happen for you, babe. Let's move on with your life. She never did that. And so it was really, it was really great to be able to call her and say, hey, you know, it's happened and thank you. And she was obviously going to be the first person that I called.
Then he called his brothers, other family members and friends, and got ready. He was given a jersey with his name on it. He signed a contract for $500 using his finger on an iPhone. But while George was getting ready to fill in as backup goalie, there was no backup equipment manager, so George stuck to his regular duties. During the game, he perched himself on the bench near the tunnel to the locker room. And while his teammates were on the ice, George, in his full goalie pads, sharpened skates and fetched sticks. But toward the end of the game, with the Hurricanes trailing the Lightning 3-1, George turned his full attention to the ice.
And it's funny because I kept on looking up at the clock and thinking to myself, this whole thing is almost over. This was such a great opportunity. It's almost over. And as the seconds were ticking away at the end of the game there, it started heading down the tunnel. And that's when I heard my name. And I was like, someone needs something. And I see Coach pop his head over and he's like, get your gear on. And then it was weird because I was like, I thought the game was over. I didn't hear the buzzer, but I was like, I thought it was over.
George had already started packing up his stuff, but play had stopped for icing, and there were still 7.6 seconds left. The Hurricanes' starting goalie told George to hurry up and get out on the ice. After all, they do pay people to handle the equipment. One of George's coworkers fetched his mask from where he'd left it down the hallway.
You know, he handed me my mask and said to me, you know, you've waited for this your whole life. Enjoy it. And so then, you know, I put my mask on and one of the referees, he came over and he gave me a tap on the back and kind of, and I think what he said to me in my ear was, hurry up and get in there. And and I was like, oh, yeah, this is taking way too long.
The TV announcers were less concerned about the delay.
George Elms coming in the game, and this is one of the coolest things I've ever seen.
George skated over to the net.
I remember thinking to myself, don't stretch when you get to the net. It's only 7 seconds. Don't stretch. You're going to look stupid. And thinking in my head, I'm like, I can't believe it. I'm actually in an NHL game.
Then he heard the announcer call his name.
And I remember thinking at that moment, too, all these people are wondering, who is George Alves? Like, what just happened? Who is this guy?
The ref dropped the puck. It stayed on the other end of the ice, about as far from George as possible. George Alves, equipment manager, finished his NHL debut with 0 saves and 0 goals allowed in 7.6 seconds of play. Despite their team's loss, Hurricanes players stayed on the ice after the buzzer to celebrate with George. They made sure he got the game puck. When George got to his phone, he had more than 100 messages. He called his wife.
I mean, she was so excited, so happy. She told me about, you know, them watching it on TV. With there being 7 seconds left, a lot of people probably would change the channel by that point. And I kind of expected her to do the same. I mean, not in a bad way, but, you know, I was like, okay, she probably didn't even see it. It happened so quickly. But no, she was telling me that she saw that I was going to grab a stick. And even though that was my job, she realized it was my stick. And she was like, oh, my God, it's his stick. He's grabbing his stick. He's going in. So I wish I had video of that.
The Hurricanes' regular backup goalie is now healthy. George's 15 minutes of fame lasted 7.6 seconds. And George Alves is perfectly happy with that.
I'm not a National Hockey League goalie, but I am, in fact, an equipment manager, and I love coming to work every day, and that's what I do, that's what I love to do, and that's what I'm going to continue to do.
That's Carolina Panthers equipment manager George Alves speaking with Only a Game's Martin Kessler. You can find pictures of George Alves sharpening his teammate skates in his goalie gear at onlyagame.org. I've never played alongside the pros in a game, even for 7.6 seconds. I have talked my way into the periphery of their games a couple of times. Once, as I've previously recounted, Owen Fogg Wolford threw a pitch my way at about 100 miles an hour. It appeared suddenly under my chin. I stepped away and waited quietly for time and space to assume their customary dimensions. They are not like us, these pro athletes. Sometimes they might seem to be. Watch a knuckleballer pitch, and you might say to yourself, I could hit that. No, you couldn't. My first glimpse into the gap between the people who play our games brilliantly and the rest of us came when I was 13. I was playing hockey in a recreational league in northern New Jersey. Saturday mornings, our games were at an arena spacious and grand enough so that the Kingston Trio played there when I was in junior high. It was full that night. At 5:30 on a Saturday morning, it was only sleepy parents and a couple of maintenance guys. The snack bar wasn't even open. We played Friday nights on an outdoor rink. There was a snack bar there, too, right beside the rink. It had French fries. Sometimes players who didn't care what their parents or coaches thought would wobble into the snack bar on their blades and buy the fries between shifts, then leave them on the bench to get cold when they returned to the ice. One evening in the winter of 62-63, three of the New York Rangers arrived at that outdoor rink where we were practicing. Two of them, Vic Hadfield and Jim Nielsen, were rookies. Both would go on to have fine careers. The third, Camille Henry, had been steadily employed by the Rangers for nearly 10 years. Who knows how he got roped into driving out to the Willowbrook Arena with a couple of rooks to put on a clinic for some New Jersey peewees. I think there was a reporter at the rink. He, or somebody, asked me what I'd learned from my fellow defenseman, Jim Nielsen. He told me to dig in harder with the toes of my skates when I was going backwards, I said. I don't remember a lot of things, but I remember that. And I remember that when the clinic was over, Camille Henry, the veteran, told us all to come out on the ice together. He dropped a puck at his feet, massaged it for a moment with his stick, and then he said, "See if you can take it away from me." Camille Henry was 5'10", and he weighed a little more than 150 pounds. There must have been 40 of us on the ice. Some of us were bigger than he was, but his nickname was Camille the Eel, and he dipped and dodged and spun around the ice, making cuts that left us laughing. Nobody got anywhere near the puck. Nobody could touch him. When we were tired, Camille Henry stopped. We all left that practice with autographs, and the thoughtful among us learned a lesson. Sure, we were playing hockey. Those pros, they were playing another game entirely. We have lots more coming up on Only a Game, but first I'd like to thank Soccer Crazy Drake, who left this review of our podcast. I listen to this podcast faithfully. I can indulge in my love of sports while listening to thoughtful stories that inspire and inform me. Thanks for that nice review, Soccer Crazy Drake. Consider a review of your own on iTunes or Stitcher. It helps other listeners to find our show. I'm Bill Littlefield, and it's time for three stories you should know. Our guests this week are both from Washington, D.C., but don't worry, the inauguration is not one of our three topics. Joining me are Cindy Boren of The Washington Post and Patrick Ruby of Vice Sports via Skype. Welcome back to both of you.
Thank you.
Great to be here, as always.
Cindy, I understand that your story is, in fact, set thousands of miles from Washington, D.C. Please begin.
All right. Well, let's talk about something that happened at the University of Oregon, where they have a state-of-the-art strength and training facility that costs something like $68 million. But evidently, the supervisory standards that are, you know, just a notch below your average daycare center. Three members of the football team were hospitalized last week for days after an intense boot camp-style workout. Now, you know, we all understand that spring football is approaching, believe it or not. And there's a new coach in town in Eugene. But during this workout, some players passed out. Others complained afterward that their urine was dark, which is a sign of a problem. And one of the linemen supposedly is suffering from rhabdomyolysis, which is a terrible condition in which your muscles can break down. You can experience blood clotting. It can even lead to kidney damage. The coach was suspended for a month. My question is that enough? Should the NCAA be looking into maybe establishing standards for strength and conditioning coaches? The NCAA and the University of Oregon need to use this as an excuse to take a good long look at their standards.
To me, this is a really clear example of why college athletes need more rights. They need more power. They need a union, potentially. They shouldn't be subjected to something like this. This doesn't happen in pro sports. The athletes could protect themselves. There are a lot more rules in terms of what you can and can't do in terms of workouts, whether it's in season, off season. The power isn't all on one side of the table. This is not new. This has happened before. The NCAA, if it's going to exist, this is the kind of thing they should be policing. Instead of all the time and money they spend, you know, trying to make sure nobody's getting cash under the table, putting the wrong topping on their bagel, maybe they should take all that time, effort, personnel, and put it towards making sure that athletes aren't being worked out, like, literally close to death.
Of course, it's alarming that this happened. Somehow even more alarming to me is that some of the players tweeted their support for the strength coach. I'm not surprised there are still coaches who overwork players in ways that turn out to be damaging. I am a little surprised in 2017 that the players aren't sort of more aware and more conscious of the rights that they do have, namely the right to protect themselves in this circumstance.
You know, I think that there is so much competition for these starting positions. There's a new coach. There's a desire to impress a new coach. Maybe some of the players were a little bit out of shape. You know, some these guys were offensive linemen and a tight end. I think two of the three weighed over 300 pounds. You also have to have an awareness and a consciousness that you have to handle 300 pounders differently. You know, you're talking about kids, teenagers. They're really not aware of their rights. And, of course, you know, at the university level, all they have to do is assert their rights, and the coach can say, oh, well, you know, I'll find somebody else.
Yeah, and there goes your scholarship.
Yeah.
Right. Patrick, please take us to the fine state of Arizona.
Yeah, so I've got another college sports-related story. This one's about an Arizona basketball player named Alonzo Trier. He's a very good player, hasn't played all season, has been sort of laboring under a mysterious suspension. We found out this week what the suspension is all about. Essentially, he tested positive for a PED. And again, the details are a little sketchy, but essentially he was in a car accident in the offseason. Somebody gave him some sort of drug to help recover that is on the NCAA's ban list. You know, it showed up when they tested him. He took it totally unknowingly. And, you know, he presented his case to the NCAA, and they actually said, okay, but you still can't play until the level of this drug in your system goes below some sort of threshold that the NCAA has for it. So basically, this guy is, you know, going and taking urine tests every week or the other week and just waiting for this to clear. So to me, this kind of speaks something good about the NCAA, which is, unlike what we've seen in some other sports, they are actually able to take an appeal, listen to it, and say, you know what? Yeah, we're going to believe you. We're not going to just hold you flat out responsible for everything in your body, period. But on the flip side, this idea of you have to get below this certain threshold, even though whatever it is not helping you at all, it's not actually enhancing your performance, that seems a little bit ridiculous.
Cindy, what do you think? Send him back out on the court or keep him on the sidelines until he's utterly clean?
I tend to side with Patrick on this. And I think that if there were a clear-cut answer, you know, everyone from, oh, I don't know, the IOC to the NFL to every other sport would really want it and would be seeking it out. What irks me about it, though, is the reluctance of anyone at the school or the NCAA to talk about it. Hmm. You know, the NCAA defers to the school, and the school doesn't have any comment. And I think there just need to be answers in such a way that does not violate any of the rights of the individual. There's got to be some accountability here somehow.
I'm going to keep my comment very short on this one. It's a story about the NCAA. Logic is absent from the story. I'm sorry, I've been redundant. Patrick, wrap it up for us.
I mean, it's just one of these cases where you're punishing someone who didn't do anything wrong. And to me, that seems wrong. That's far worse than having whatever trace metabolites in your system, whatever drug you didn't intentionally take, and that isn't giving you any sort of performance advantage anyway. But, you know, it does speak to sort of this larger drug war we've talked about on here before. When you try to set up these systems to police these kinds of very complicated things, you often end up with these sort of cases. And it does sort of raise the bigger question of what are we really trying to do here?
All right, it's my turn, and I promise not to talk about the inauguration, but I have to bring up a story that has some political implications. This week, the Supreme Court put off the decision on whether to hear a case concerning whether New Jersey casinos should be allowed to offer betting on sports. The Supreme Court wants to hear an opinion from the U.S. Solicitor General, whoever that might turn out to be, before deciding whether to take the case. And, of course, the man who will appoint the Solicitor General used to have his name on casinos in New Jersey, but they were closed because of bankruptcy. So no conflict of interest there, I guess, at least as far as New Jersey goes. But here's the question that goes beyond the Trump administration. People already bet billions of dollars each year on sports illegally at the corner store or the bar or wherever. Would legalizing sports betting change that behavior? And would it change anything about the games? And if the answer is no, should it simply be legalized? Should there be 50 states in which you can bet on the Super Bowl legally? Patrick?
I mean, when you put it that way, it's kind of hard to not say, yes, we should make this legal. I mean, look, if it's something that's already happening, which it is, and essentially what we're doing by making it illegal is we are not sort of taking our cut, as the government could be taking a cut. Maybe we put some of that money to something useful for society. To me, that makes a lot of sense. And the other thing I would say is, look, we already have lotteries, like in every state, just about. You know, they're gambling. They actually function as regressive taxes in a lot of ways. They're somewhat objectionable because you're essentially taking money from poor people and transferring it to wealthier people through the government. I think there's actually a better case against the lottery than there is against sports gambling. Mm. And I think if we're going to allow one, you probably should allow the other.
Cindy, what do you think?
Well, I'm troubled by the notion that, you know, if gambling were legalized, somehow this would all go to a greater good for society. I seem to remember that lotteries were justified by, oh, that will help pay for the education system, and that doesn't appear to be the case. The other thing for me is, are the athletes allowed to participate? I can't imagine that that's really going to be allowed by anyone. It would probably make Pete Rose pretty happy, and we could go back and relitigate that whole Pete Rose
issue. I was going to say, if this goes through, Pete Rose goes into the Hall of Fame right away.
Something new to obsess over.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I don't know. I'm with you on the regressive tax problem. And the issue for me is that if sports gambling were to become legal, more and more people would do it. It's been demonstrated through the lottery that the people who buy lottery tickets are the people who have a dream that they're somehow going to get the money. And so it goes from the poor to the state, and the state doesn't give it back to right. a great extent to the poor. I think that would be compounded. I don't know. I'm not really in favor of seeing more legalized gambling. We got more than enough already, I think.
We've got daily fantasy sports. I mean, so we're already halfway
and the leagues are involved.
Right. I think the real league opposition to this, and always has been, is because they have never figured out how to get their cut. If they can ever figure out how to take their cut,
right.
especially the NFL,
right.
we'll have sports gambling legal tomorrow.
My guests for this week's Three Stories You Should Know have been Patrick Ruby of Vice Sports and Cindy Boren of The Washington Post. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you so much.
As always, thanks.
My mother has a lot of friends, and sometimes she tells me about one of them that I should interview for Only a Game because the friend has some connection to sports. That's why I introduced myself to Imogene Fish, who'd been a skier, a very good skier, in fact. She learned to ski in New Hampshire, a place with which, until 1940, she and her family were completely unfamiliar.
I was born in Germany, in Berlin, in 1932. And because of some Jewish background in my father's side of the family, they decided we needed to get out of Germany, and we left there in 1940.
The decision was easy. One night, the Gestapo had knocked at the door, asking for Imogene's father. He was hiding in a closet. Imogene's mother told the officers her husband was extremely ill, and they went away. Shortly thereafter, Imogene and her family made their way to the U.S. In Germany, Imogene's father had been a banker. For a time, the family traveled around this country looking for opportunities. In North Conway, New Hampshire, they found one.
We purchased a small, rundown inn. My mother learned to cook, and they ran that inn successfully, fairly successfully, for years and years.
Even as they were first getting established as innkeepers, Imogene's parents were determined to make their first Christmas in the U.S. memorable.
I got my skis, little wooden skis, was just thrilled and delighted. Walked up to Cranwell Mountain with some friends, and we started skiing. You walk up a ways to, I remember the boulder that we walked up to and went back down. It would get cold, and most of my friends would go into the warming hut, have some hot chocolate, and I was just driven to climb back up that little hill and ski down again and probably fall down at the bottom, but just determined to keep trying.
Keep that determination in mind. It paid off. But for a moment, let's stick with what it must have been like to be an 8-year-old, newly relocated German kid in New Hampshire when Hitler was gobbling up chunks of Europe and dropping bombs on London.
We were the only German family in that little town, and it was quite difficult to make our way. People were somewhat suspect of us in terms of Nazis, spies, etc., etc.
Young Imogene was fortunate to have parents who protected their children from the ugliness and harassment they sometimes encountered as adults, and perhaps she was also fortunate that neither of her parents was inclined to try skiing. She was free to practice on her own without parental misguidance. She found a role model outside the family circle.
I do remember being maybe in the 5th or 6th grade, and there was a woman from North Conway. Her name was Paula Kahn.
Paula Kahn, who is 94 now and lives in Vienna, represented the U.S. in the 1948 Olympics. Even before that experience, she had stories for the youngsters in that New Hampshire school.
She came to talk and play the accordion and yodel at this elementary school. And I was enthralled by her. She talked a little bit about her skiing, that she had been in Colorado to race. And suddenly I thought, that would be absolutely my dream, is to do what Paula has done.
The dream seemed unlikely. Imogene hadn't started skiing as early as a lot of her classmates had. She was persistent, but would that be enough? A few years later, she began to find out.
I tried out for the Kennett High School Conway ski team, and I was the only girl selected for that. There were only 5 on the team, and I was the only girl, which led to, back then, a lot of teasing about bathrooms and, you know, all that kind of stuff.
After high school, Imogene enrolled at the University of New Hampshire. During the winter of 1950, she met an older ski racer who mentioned that she might want to try out for the Olympic team.
And I said, I could never. I'm not nearly good enough. At the time, Cranwell Mountain and the mountains in the east did not offer the kind of terrain that I would need to train on. So I took a year off from college, again with the support of my parents, and went to Sun Valley, Idaho.
Sun Valley had not only the terrain, but the coaches who could turn aspiring skiers into Olympians. Imogene Fish waited tables between the races that would determine who'd go to the 1952 Olympics in Norway. Fish won the first such event, but before the second, she came down with the flu and learned that the team manager had some common sense.
I was going to get out of bed and get myself in that race even with 104 temperature, but she said, Imogene, the kind of people we want on this team are more sensible than that. So I missed that race, but then did fine in the remaining 2. Lo and behold, at the end of the winter and after the final race, I had indeed made the team.
Imogene called home. Her parents were understandably proud and then some.
I think they were more interested in me going to the Olympics and perhaps beating some of the German skiers than they were anything else. They would never confess to that. But
so the idea was, it's you don't necessarily have to come home with a medal, but please beat the Germans.
Yes, yes. And I did beat a few of the Germans, but a couple of them beat me. So
lovely and simple, too. A happy ending for a young skier and 2 proud parents, a dozen years after they fled the country where they were born, the country they left to escape imprisonment and, very likely, death. Except that, as Imogene Fish recalled while we talked, her story, like most stories, was not as simple as it might have seemed.
My mother had left a son from a different marriage in Germany who was in the German army and so could not come to the U.S. with us, who was then missing in action in Stalingrad. I just feel that they had been seen through so much that they just felt blessed that something this wonderful would happen to them, that the country they had chosen had then chosen their daughter to represent them. And it was just very satisfying for them.
Imogene Fish re-enrolled in college when she returned from Oslo, this time at Mount Holyoke, where she's in the Athletic Hall of Fame. She earned a couple of master's degrees, built a career in education, raised a family, and helped set up an integrated school and summer camp during the civil rights movement. Recently, for a profile that appeared in a Mount Holyoke publication, she was asked if she had any advice for aspiring Olympians. "If you're going to do well," she said, "you have to go a little bit faster than you think it's probably smart to do." We'll be right back with Charlie Pierce and more sports NPR style. Ahead on Only a Game, an American baseball coach looks for diamonds in the rough in Uganda.
I step out onto this little compound and I look down on two beautiful Little League baseball fields. I was excited for what was going to happen.
And you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR. Coming up next week on Only a Game, the only sports bar I know of that's not open on Friday night or during the day on Saturday. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
Which is more surprising to you, that Jeff Bagwell, Tim Raines, and Pudge Rodriguez were voted into baseball's Hall of Fame, or that Roger Clemens and Barry Bonds got more votes this time around than they did last year?
Neither one of them is too surprising. The biggest surprise to me was that Vlad Guerrero didn't get in.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe the Expos contingent among the voters didn't want to split their votes this time. No, it's very encouraging that Bonds and Clemens got more votes than they did the last time. Maybe the hysteria is passing.
The Oakland Raiders are one step closer to becoming the Vegas Golden Raiders or Caesars Raiders or Raiders on the Strip or whatever they're going to. Anyway, they filed paperwork this week for their relocation. Will the black and silver hit the jackpot in Las Vegas?
I still don't know. I think the first year will be great. They'll get all kinds of attention. Every major publication will be, and television network will be out there covering them. After a couple of years, though, you know, I'm not sure they won't be just another, you know, artificial Eiffel Tower and, you know, pyramid. The one thing they are getting, which I don't think they expected when they first decided to move there, is that it's a pretty good team that's moving there now.
Except that pretty good team is going to have to play for two more years in Oakland before this move happens. I'll bet that'll be fun.
Oh, boy, I'll tell you what. The Oakland Coliseum there, that's falling apart anyway. I'm telling you, I wouldn't go near that place for the next 2 years without heavy armor.
On Monday night, the Pittsburgh Penguins and the Washington Capitals combined to score 15 goals. Pittsburgh won the game 8-7 with a 3-on-3 overtime goal. I bet you wish you'd been to that game.
I'll tell you, I was so wishing I was there. First of all, I love 3-on-3 hockey.
Yeah.
I think it's a wonderful idea. But those two teams, I mean, you know, this is now the rivalry, I think, in the NHL.
Well, it certainly is in terms of number of goals scored. But the weirdest statistic about that night's action is, guess who didn't score? Alex Ovechkin.
Yeah, I don't know how he missed that. Was any? Were we sure?
Everybody scores tonight.
Were we sure he was there?
All right. Are you ready for this week's sports shocker?
Sure.
All right. Last weekend, the UConn women's basketball team won its 91st game in a row, breaking their own record for consecutive wins. Who saw that one coming?
It goes on. And if you talk to people who follow this more closely than I do, they will tell you nobody expected this from UConn at the beginning of the year.
Except the people who were paying attention. We learned this week that former Yankee Alex Rodriguez will host a reality show featuring broke former athletes. According to CNBC, these athletes will meet with, quote, money-savvy mentors who can help them get back on their feet. I'm sure there have been worse ideas for a TV show, but I can't think of one off the top of my head.
Well, yeah, especially when you're considering that a lot of these athletes are broke in the first place because they met money-savvy mentors.
Exactly. Also called agents. Brings to mind the great Woody Allen line where in one of his movies he plays a financial advisor and somebody says, "What's a financial advisor exactly?" And he says, "I work with people's money until it's gone."
I was thinking more of take the money and run. Give me the money, I have a gub.
Each year, everybody involved with a Super Bowl halftime show has to figure out something more spectacular or more outrageous than whatever happened at the previous Super Bowls. Lady Gaga is going all in on that. She wants to perform on the roof of NRG Stadium at halftime. won't that provide the fans of the game with an odd angle from which to watch her performance?
I was going to say, who's going to watch her? The people in the helicopters? The Goodyear blimp?
Exactly.
And also, she's going to, I mean, I know wireless technology is really something, but I have a horrible feeling that right in the middle of one of her big numbers, you're going to hear, American 2-4, maintain flight level 15,000.
And finally, Charlie, this year, for the first time, the annual Puppy Bowl, the Super Bowl for people who would rather watch dogs than football, will feature disabled puppies. And one of the puppies is blind, one is deaf, and one has only three legs. So at last, the long national nightmare of non-inclusive Puppy Bowl is over.
I think the three you mentioned, though, are probably, you know, puppies who made a career out of Puppy Bowl. And that's what happens to them when you play any kind of football.
Seriously, though, the dogs in the Puppy Bowl come from shelters. I'm betting that each of those three dogs finds a home before halftime. You think I'm going to win that one?
I don't think there's any question. I just hope Lady Gaga doesn't adopt them and they have to bring the dog to the roof of the stadium.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated. And he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
It's the Little League World Series, and it's game number one.
Every August, thousands of Little League players, coaches, and fans gather in Williamsport, Pennsylvania. The players look like they've been hitting balls off a tee since they were 2 years old, because most of them have. Their coaches have likely worked their way up from peewees to the minors to the Little League majors. It's easy to get the impression that everybody at the Little League World Series has been singularly focused on baseball since pretty much forever. Or since however long forever is, if you're a 13-year-old. But in 2015, at least one of the coaches at the Little League World Series was not there as a result of a lifetime of determination and drive. Quite the opposite, really. Here's Only a Game's Karen Given.
Back in the spring of 2014, Evan Petty was a senior at Syracuse University, and he was feeling a little anxious.
The pressure's starting to kick in at that point. I didn't really know what it is that I was really going to do. I had always really liked sports. I got a journalism degree, but I didn't work hard enough to turn it into anything. I was never really such a go-getter. I feel like if I knew exactly what I wanted to do, I'd be able to do it. Like, I don't feel incapable, but I didn't have a whole lot call it conviction. Not a lot of strong conviction.
All right. So kind of aimless a little bit.
A little aimless.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So where did your aim first take you?
It took me to Alaska.
Evan flew to Fairbanks to write game reports for the Gold Panners, a collegiate summer team. And I'd like to say that Evan found his calling up there in Alaska, but he didn't. Not quite yet.
I guess it bought me time. That's pretty much all it did.
Evan spent that summer thinking about baseball. He'd always loved the game. He thought he'd like to be a coach, but he didn't have any training or experience. He figured he'd never find a paid job in this country, so he started looking elsewhere.
So I think that I looked in places like Japan, even, and places in Europe, Spain, they play some baseball. I took some Spanish in high school. Maybe I could make something work with that. But then Uganda came up.
Yep, Uganda. A school was looking for an English teacher / assistant baseball coach. The school is called
the Allen V. R. Stanley International School of Math and Science for the Athletically Talented.
The Allen V. R. Stanley International School was founded by an American businessman who wants to bring baseball to Uganda. Besides teaching kids math and science and English, the school had another well-publicized goal, to send a team to Williamsport. Evan had been watching the Little League World Series on TV since he was 13. He loves it.
The quality of play is so high and everything about it is so emotional and real. It's raw. Like, it's so raw. It's just the best.
As Allen V.R. Stanley's assistant coach, Evan would have the chance to go to Williamsport and be a part of it all. Not only that, but
was it difficult to get the job? Were there lots of applicants?
I don't think so. Not a lot of people want to go to Uganda.
So Evan hopped on an airplane and flew to Kampala.
It was 2 a.m. when I got there. My boss picked me up, and he just said, "Welcome to Africa," and he's telling me about how everything's green, but of course I can't see anything. In the pitch dark, and I was so delirious that I just kind of went into bed. And then the next morning I woke up and there are birds chirping and the sun is out, and I step out onto this little compound and I look down and two beautiful Little League baseball fields. I was excited for what was going to happen.
When Evan saw the baseball team he'd be coaching, he was even more excited. It's not that the players had a lot of experience. In fact, many of them had none at all, but...
Put it this way, balls were being thrown very fast and bats were being swung very hard and players were running very fast. There was a lot of raw talent everywhere.
It's probably a good idea to pause here and consider some of the reasons why Evan Petty should not have been so optimistic. Uganda has a short and not very successful relationship with the Little League World Series. Each year, teams from Europe, Africa, and the Middle East meet in Poland for their qualifying tournament. Uganda lost in their first trip to Poland in 2008. In 2009, they skipped the tournament and spent the money building dormitories instead. In 2010...
They got to Poland, and they lost by nature of one of the more bizarre tiebreakers you're ever going to hear about.
It was a quirky run differential rule that even the coaches didn't understand. Basically, by scoring four runs in the last inning of their last game, Uganda inadvertently allowed another team to advance. In 2011, the team won the qualifying tournament in Poland, but the players were denied visas to come to the United States. Many of the players don't have birth certificates. Paperwork is hard in Uganda, Evan told me. In 2012, the Ugandan team finally made it to Williamsport, but lost all three of their official games. The following 2 years, they couldn't even get the visas to go to the qualifier in Poland. And that brings us to 2015, when Evan Petty moved to Uganda and the team finally got their paperwork sorted out.
So we had to do a whole lot of stuff and satisfy a whole lot of people and pay a whole lot of money. And then we had to win the games, and that was the easy part.
And it really was easy. Uganda won their five games in Poland by a combined score of 64-2. But you wouldn't have known how lopsided their victories had been by the way the team celebrated after their final game.
Just dancing, cartwheels, backflips. We were pumped up.
Uganda was headed back to Williamsport, and they had one simple goal.
Shock the world. I mean, they had heard about that the games were going to be on TV and that there were going to be thousands of people in the stands. And, like, they wanted to show up and, like, play well in front of those people. They're fearless. They don't fear making mistakes. They just wanted to go and play.
No African team had ever won anything other than a consolation game in the Little League World Series. And the odds were stacked against Uganda this time, too.
And that will be the first run of the Little League World Series. It goes to Uganda.
The team played in the very first game of the tournament against the Dominican Republic, the country that has produced David Ortiz, Pedro Martinez, and Sammy Sosa.
Francis Alemo started the game on the mound, finishes it in center field. Ball game over, and what a win for the kids from Uganda.
And listen to the crowd.
ESPN came calling, and we were on SportsCenter the next morning, and Baseball Tonight, and all of this, and we were like the story of the first day. They were soaking it all in right away. They knew that it was a big deal.
There were a lot of firsts for the team in Williamsport, but in their second game against Venezuela, they were reminded that not all firsts are fun.
The team, they hadn't lost yet. Like, those guys hadn't lost. No one in Uganda could beat them. No one in Europe could beat them. No one in the rest of Africa could have beat them had they shown up to Europe, and the Dominican Republic couldn't beat them. So now here we go. We're playing Venezuela. That's like the first game in their lives that they lost. They were subdued, to say the least. We lost to Venezuela, and then we played Chinese Taipei 2 days later. And if you lose to Chinese Taipei, at least you're losing to Chinese Taipei. It's an honor, in a way. They're really, really good, those kids.
I asked Evan if his players saw losing to Chinese Taipei as an honor. He said, not really, but...
They don't get too down. They're kids. It's just a game. That's the beauty of the Little League World Series and how raw it is that they love playing those games, and they played really well, but... They didn't hang their heads for too long.
Evan and his players returned to Uganda, triumphant, but with plenty of what Evan calls unfinished business. Uganda wants to win the whole thing someday. Why not, Evan says. But as the 2016 tournament approached,
we didn't even try to get the visas because Little League, they said no.
Schools that specialize in sports are banned from the Little League World Series, and tournament organizers decided that the Allen V. R. Stanley International School of Math and Science for the athletically talented shouldn't be allowed to compete. Rules are rules, Evan says, but in Uganda, there really isn't anywhere else for kids to play baseball.
You can only play against the same 150 kids in school so often. It's sad for all of us who are involved in developing baseball there because that's how you fall in love with the game. That's how you fall in love with the game of baseball. So as far as someone who's concerned about just developing the game in Uganda, it's tough because, like, these are the events that would help us get there.
With the country's Little League dreams on hold, Uganda is focusing on getting the national team ready to qualify for the 2020 World Baseball Classic and the Tokyo Olympics. If I had told Evan Petty that it sounds like he's found his calling, he probably would have turned a shade of pink and squirmed in his chair. He doesn't see it as a calling. So instead, I asked him if he was planning on staying in Uganda to see things through.
I'm invested in what we do. I don't want to give up on it, you know. But it's tough, too. Every time I come home, everyone's always asking me that question. And it's like, I feel bad if I say yes. But I'd like to continue to see growth and be there for it and help it along.
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Martin Kessler. We had help this week from Alex Schroeder and Mike Moschetto. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Welcome to our new intern, Ryan Fitzgerald, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word this week comes from Carolina Hurricanes equipment manager George Alves, who recalls the dietary blunder he committed leading up to his impromptu stint as an NHL goalie.
That afternoon, I actually had a cup of ice cream. Little did I know I was going to be dressing that night. So.
Well, it didn't slow you down too much in those 7 seconds you were in the net, and who knows, maybe Ben and Jerry's is going to come up with a special flavor for you, Icy Netminder Crunch or something like that. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports, NPR style, on Only a Game. Thanks for listening.